Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. My co-host is Bill McHenry. Bill, how are you doing today?
Absolutely terrific, Ron.
That's super. Well, you know, Bill, on Launch, we focus on the launching of a business so that entrepreneurs and our listeners can successfully navigate their launch. This morning, we'll be featuring Chris Hawker of Triton Design. But before we get started, Bill, could you thank today's sponsor?
I sure will, Ron. Today, our sponsor is Envision Sales and Marketing. Envision Sales and Marketing is your one-stop source for all your sales, marketing, and business development needs. We customize and implement a business strategy to help build your business, grow your sales, and encourage your success.
And we really appreciate their support.
Well, Ron, we do. And today, our guest is Chris Hawker. Chris is the founder of an award-winning inventor-oriented industrial design firm called Trident Design. He's based in Columbus, Ohio, and not only has Chris been very successful in his business with Trident Design, but he's also an avid inventor, and he's invented a lot of problem-solving gadgets like the power squid and the onion goggles, which I've actually seen, Ron, and they're very cool. Many of Chris's products are sold in major retailers around the country. They even include Walmart, Target, and Bed Bath & Beyond, to name a few. Chris has 10 years of being a full-time professional inventor, and one of the things that he's real proud of is his little boy is 8 months old today. It's his first son. So I want to welcome Chris to our show.
Hey, hi, Bill. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, of course. We're looking forward to having a conversation with Chris. Tell us a little bit about Trident Design and what your business is.
Well, Trident Design is a product development firm. We do industrial design on consumer products primarily, as well as packaging design, graphic design, branding, naming, and anything creative around developing a product and then bringing it to market. We work on a variety of internally generated products that we take and license to market. We also do specialize in working with independent inventors who come to us with ideas that we help develop into marketable products and then help them navigate the process of bringing to market. And then lastly, we do corporate design for other companies who have products that they need to develop or package or brand.
Okay, well,
go ahead. I was saying we have about 10 people and the company, so it's a small company, but we're very busy right now and definitely growing like crazy.
So the economy hadn't really impacted your business then?
Well, you know, it had the last couple of years, but somewhere around the middle of last year, there was a noticeable change in the reactions of the clients we were bidding jobs to, and we saw somewhere around last July things pick back up in a big way, and then the momentum just continues to build. So at this point, for us, no recession.
How about that? Well, how did you get started in the business of inventing?
I got started inventing when I was a teenager. I had an aquarium maintenance business that I set up and maintained high-end reef aquariums in offices and people's homes. And I realized that I could make more money selling equipment than I could, you know, spending my time getting paid by the hour to scrape algae. And then at some point I realized that I had ideas for my own equipment, so I started designing and building my own filtration to sell to my clients. Later on, I developed an aquarium filter that I decided I would mass produce and try to sell into the market, and I did that right as I was entering college. That business failed, but I got the bug for product development, entrepreneurship, and then I just kept sticking at it. After that, I did an algae scraper for the aquarium business that was a high-end algae removal tool that is today used in most of the public aquariums in this country, and it became the standard in the aquarium industry for algae removal tools, which was kind of something I never anticipated going into business, that algae scrapers would play such a big role, but this business I have today is built on the back of that algae scraper.
That's pretty incredible. You know, they're on cable television, they have, I forget which one it is, that they have something called America's Dirtiest Jobs. I've never seen algae scraping, but I'm sure it would be right up there at the top.
Yeah, well, it's definitely it can be messier than you'd expect. And so after the algae scraper happened and became successful, I thought to myself, man, it's pretty easy to make money developing products. I'm going to start developing more products in a variety of industries where I had interests, guitar accessories. I'm a guitar player, so I had ideas there. And I had some gardening product and cooking product ideas. And my first experience with the algae scraper had happened pretty smoothly from I had the idea and developed it, brought it to market, and it was an instant success. And really that was beginner's luck, it turns out, because every product I've done since then, none of them has been as easy as that one was to get out to market and build success with. So if I had known then what I know now, it would have maybe been a different story. But I got into it, and then I was in it, and I figured out how to make it work. It took a while.
That's true. So many entrepreneurs think, a lot of people think that it's really easy and to be an entrepreneur, and it really is not.
Right. I think like anything, it has pros and cons. And I could never give up the freedom that I have of running my own schedule and being the king of my own little hill. But it comes with the other side of that sword is that, you know, I never get to really be off. I go on vacation, I have to answer my emails and stay in touch with my office. I can't really ever let go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of, who have you worked with in the past, Chris? And I think our listeners would be real fascinated. I know you've worked with a lot of big organizations like Philips, but who else have you worked with besides companies like that?
Well, we've worked with Philips, and we're doing some work with Stanley right now, but we also do work with a lot of smaller companies. I find for our company, the sweet spot are companies in the $10 million to $100 million in sale range, because for doing the kind of work we're doing, it's very helpful to not be dealing with committees, but to be dealing with the people who are making decisions. So in the housewares industry, we work with Polder, we work with RSVP, we work with a company out of Germany called Rosla, that we're actually the 150-year-old company. We're the first American company they've ever worked with on designer engineering, so that's a very cool story. And we're working with Lifetime Brands on a product right now, which is the largest manufacturer of kitchen gadgets. So we're kind of all over the place in terms of the size of the companies we deal with. And like I said, we also deal with individual inventors. So we've got two sort of tracks to our industrial design services, one geared towards corporate clients who have certain needs and certain types of budgets. And then we have another track geared towards inventors who really, you know, can't necessarily afford the same level of diligence on the products, but who are usually looking to license their products, and so they don't need to be developed all the way, so we can help them take them where they need to get in order to get out there. So mm-hmm. we really can adapt to working with, you know, multi-billion dollar organizations down to individual, you know, police officer who has an idea for a better lock.
How did you market Trident Design to, you mentioned a company in Germany, how do you market Trident Design to companies like that looking for new business?
Virtually all of our marketing is through word of mouth and going to trade shows and just developing relationships over many years. So I started going to the houseware show, for example, the first year I started my business in 2000, and so this will be my 11th year in a row going to the houseware show. And the first couple of years I went, I would walk around and introduce myself at booths, and, you know, people didn't know who I was, but they met me, and then the next year I showed up, and the next year I showed up, and about the fourth year, these people met me, even though we'd never done anything more than say hello at the booth. They felt like we were old friends because we'd said hello so many times, and eventually those same people started sending me jobs, and so most of it's been through that kind of effort and then word of mouth. The only advertising we do at all is on the United Inventors Association website.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to people like to do business with people they know and trust. So after 4 years, they felt like they knew you and they could trust you.
Yeah, and I, you know, every year I managed to get a few projects out early in my business. I, you know, there wasn't a year that went by that more products didn't come out and that I grew my portfolio. And so as I approached people in subsequent years, I had more and more evidence that we could deliver on our promises.
Okay. Well, what were your most successful products?
By far, our most successful product has been the Power Squid, which we licensed to Philips Electronics. Actually, we originally licensed it to a company called Power Century that Philips shortly thereafter swallowed in order to become start an accessories division. And that product then, you know, eventually eventually was sold in pretty much every major retailer in the country and has sold millions of units, and it's been very successful for us. And fundamentally, it's a power strip that has the outlets situated at the end of short extension cords, giving a squid-like look, but also giving it enhanced flexibility and reach. And you have those bulky transformer block plugs that cover multiple outlets in the traditional strip on the power squid. They never take up more than one outlet. Most importantly, it looks really cool, and it's got a really cool name. So this is the kind of product we try to create every time, is we take an ordinary, everyday object, and we turn it into something that's very cool, that celebrates its function, that says, what I do is really important and cool. Because a lot of the products that we see in the world, and I think this is true in a lot of people's businesses, the design of the product, whether it's a physical product like we specialize in, or even if it's an informational service product, the design of it says that what it does is boring. And so you can actually, I think, dramatically change the perception of a product or a service by the way you make it look and how you make it work. We also had in the housewares industry, as Bill mentioned, we had a product called Onion Goggles, which are kind of a funny, you know, they're goggles. You don't cry when you chop onions. Which seems like a silly thing, and a lot of people online write about the onion goggles as being an example of bad product because it's a monotasker, and people are like, oh, this thing's stupid, but they talk about it like crazy, and we sell 100,000 a year of the onion goggles, so it's been a very successful business for something that's really quite silly, I think, but people love them.
That's incredible. Yeah, my office needs a power squid because I've got those transformers. You know, I'm just glad the fire marshal doesn't come by and see how much stuff I've got into all the power strips.
Yeah, they come in real handy. People love them.
I remember you said that the power squid won the award of the best new product at CES show a couple years ago or something.
Yeah, that was actually 2006 now. It won the Best of Innovations Award and the People's Choice Award, which was voted on by the attendees, which was kind of funny. It was the first year they'd had a People's Choice Award, and it was sponsored by Scientific American, who was hoping to sell ad space to the winner. And so we were competing in the People's Choice Award with people like Samsung and Sony and big names. And then, but the people, instead of voting for a new fancy TV or big speakers, they voted for the Power Squid, which was just an everyday problem solver, but it won the award. And so Scientific American came to my little company asking if we wanted to take an 8-page ad out in Scientific American to celebrate our award. And what the ad cost was like twice our annual budget at that point in time. And so we're like, well, no, thank you. And so they failed to sell the ad space. And then, surprise, surprise, it was the first and last year they ever had a Scientific American People's Choice Award.
Did they run the ad, though?
No, because we couldn't.
They still would.
So we got a mention in the magazine as the winner, as like a little corner spot. But I don't think they felt like they got their money's worth for the effort. But, you know, and now PowerSquid's coming out through Stanley and Westinghouse, so it's continuing to evolve and grow. And in our business, you get a big, successful product, and then you're looking for ways to leverage it from then on. So it's part of what we do every day, even though the product was initially invented 10 years ago.
So Philips doesn't have the license to it anymore? It's now with Stanley and Westinghouse?
Philips still has the license as well. It was an exclusive period, which has ended. And so now we're at the phase in the product life cycle. You know, every product goes through a life cycle where it's new and exciting because it's different, but then it becomes less exciting and less of a halo product for the company. And so now we're going for proliferation through multiple licensees who can bring it out and then compete on price rather than newness.
Okay. So you're approaching two different companies to license it now.
Well, there's also two other companies involved as well, Bits Limited and a company called Excel, who specializes in the CEDIA custom install space. So it's really a multiple-prong approach, though we're trying not to have two players who fill the same ecological niche involved in the product at the same time. So everyone is fitting into a piece of a puzzle.
Okay. Oh, wow. Trying to get someone in each market segment.
Each market, someone who specializes. Most of them, and you know, imagine themselves to be in all market segments, but in reality, end up having one, you know, real strength.
Yeah. Well, you make the power squid sound, you know, almost easy to bring to market, but you and I both know, and our listeners too, that it's not easy to get something to market. How does someone really go about starting, Chris, getting it all the way to market? What do you have to do?
Well, if you have an idea for a product, you know, an invention, and a lot of the people who are listening to this show may be entrepreneurs but may not be product entrepreneurs, but may have ideas, and so you have options for how to, like, turn your invention idea into money. And it's not just getting a factory to manufacture your product and try to sell it, though you can always do that. That's certainly a much harder and capital and time-intensive task. As you and I both know, your experience with Widgeteer, you know, making and importing and selling a product is extremely hard work, and it's not something you can do casually. But for someone who has a great idea, you always have the option to license. And now licensing a product idea is there's a lot of misconceptions about it, and people, because of the TV shows and some of the advertisements you might see on TV, they treat the invention business something like gambling or the lottery, where if you just play enough, you know, numbers, eventually you'll win, and it's just somehow up to random probability that your product is going to succeed. But in reality, the real business of inventing, I mean, that's going on somewhere, but your chances in winning, playing it like that, are the same as winning the lottery. It's very low.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Whereas if you have an idea and you want to increase your chances, not play it lottery style, what you do is you create an idea and then you build value around it. It's what at Trident we call the value creation method. So you come up with the idea and then you try to build as much value around that idea as you can, following the 80-20 rule, which says that 80% of your value is going to come from 20% of your work. And that 20% of the work is what we specialize in at Trident Design, is coming up with the right product based on that idea. Because there's a lot of different ways any idea can turn into a product, but only some of them are going to be viable as economic opportunities. So, like, every good idea isn't an economic opportunity. It's got certain characteristics that's going to make for it. So, you know, that's the first step always, is being able to spot what ideas have a good chance of making money and, you know, what characteristics they have. And they have things like relatively low barriers to entry. I mean, if you're a physicist, engineer, and you know how to make some new nanotechnology, then you can do that. But if you're just someone who, you know, has an idea, who hasn't, you know, you're a salesman, and you have an idea in nanotechnology, you're probably biting off more than you can chew, right? So something that's got a low barrier to entry that you understand, that you can wrap your head around, like a cooking gadget or a gadget to improve, you know, working with babies or solving some kind of everyday problem. Most good ideas come out of your own experiences, not scouting around for some opportunity, but trying to solve some problem that you personally face, because there's enough people out there that if you personally face it, then you... you know, there's probably a lot of other people do. So then is that problem able to be solved with a product that is going to be inexpensive relative to the problem it's solving? And then once you've established that you've got a good idea, you need to wrap it up in a great functional design. Because when you're trying to license a product to a company, trying to sell them a product is just like trying to sell a consumer a product. You can't sell them an unfinished, poorly packaged, unprofessional-looking product. The consumer, looking past on a shelf a bunch of products, if they see something that's got bad design, looks cheap, doesn't have nice graphics, they're not going to even pay it any attention, because the market is full of such high-quality products these days. Mm-hmm. And so you got to take your idea and you got to execute it well, because licensing to the companies is the same way. You don't want to show them something unfinished, half-baked, not well thought out, that doesn't look like a product they want to throw right up on the shelf right now if they could.
Yeah.
But if you can create that illusion, now you don't have to finish it. You just have to create the illusion of something that they could put on their shelf. They'll understand that there's still some engineering to do to get the product ready to manufacture. But if you show them something that when they see it, man, they're like, man, I wish that was in my product line, then it's relatively easy to license. Mm-hmm. And then the last piece of the puzzle, of course, is intellectual property protection. As Ron well knows, the patent by itself is not the game. You know, a lot of inventors make the mistake of thinking that they just need to get a patent without the rest of the design work that really embodies the product, and that's just not true. Like, without the product design, if you just have a patent, the world does not beat a path to your door. However, if you just have a product and you have no patent, it's virtually impossible to license. Now, it is possible, and I've actually done it, but, you know, you certainly get a much lower royalty percentage, which in our case, you know, we're typically looking for 5% as a very fair royalty rate for licensing a consumer product, and sometimes as low as 2 or 3% if it's commodity-type product, and as high as 6% if it's in a market that has a little better margins. So that's the kind of percentages we're looking for, but you can't command that without a patent that will give your licensee at least the ability to try to protect your market should the product be successful.
Yeah, Chris, you're on target. You know, a patent is just one piece of a multi-piece puzzle. Well, what are a few tips about how to be successful as an inventor?
To be successful as an inventor, you really, I think, first and foremost need to understand that, like any business, inventing is a business. And it involves relationships and conversations. Inventors tend to be very paranoid because they think people are going to steal their idea. And that's usually because they vastly overestimate the value of their idea. The real value is in that value creation method I described, is like industrial design, product design, patents, all these things, you know, logos and good names, all these things build value around the idea. Yeah, I lost my train of thought there. if you're, spaced it, where was I? What was the question again?
Yeah, what are a few tips on how to be successful as an inventor?
Well, I had a train of thought there that I lost, but I'll have to start somewhere else. But to be successful as an inventor, it's a team sport. That's what I was trying to say. I knew there was something important there. It's a team sport. You can't do it all yourself. You have to gather the right team of people who can help you execute on each one of these parts with excellence, like the patent attorney, someone who understands finance, someone who understands graphic design, someone who understands product design, someone who understands sales and marketing. If you don't have each one of these elements executed with excellence, it's very difficult to be successful because the weakest link in the chain will break the chain, and each one of these things needs to be done well to succeed. And I think a lot of time people coming at a product invention think that it's all about the idea again, but it's really much more than that. It's all these things combined. Also, then being adaptable is always super important. People typically have a preconceived notion of how their product's going to get to market, and usually that's, I'm going to license it to the biggest, most obvious player. What I've found in my experience is that the biggest, most obvious player, the Philipses, the GEs, the people that have the big brands are not usually the best choice because these really large companies aren't going to be strategically interested in most people's inventions. And 3,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 unfocused people will get a lot less done than 10 very focused people. So if your product that you're trying to bring to a company is potentially going to increase their business by 10%, then everyone in that company will get involved and get aligned behind that product. Whereas if you've got a huge corporation and it's not going to even move the needle, then why should they bother getting involved? And so this kind of, you know, just being willing to adapt to things as you learn them and encounter them is key to ultimately being successful.
Yeah, you're on target about it being a team sport. I always tell my clients that, you know, the four items that you really need as an independent inventor is you have to have a great idea, you have to have the right team, you have to have a thorough plan, and you have to have adequate funding. And you really need all four of those clicking right away.
Yeah, on the last point, it's true. People think that inventing without a budget is something that's possible. And, you know, I guess in theory it's possible, but the reality is if you're going to play the game to win, it's a type of investment, and it's not inexpensive. Investing in an invention idea, if you, depending on the complexity, obviously can change dramatically, but you might be looking at a minimum of $10,000 to test the simplest of inventions, and upwards of $20,000-$30,000 for a more complicated invention. That's an everyday household problem solver type item that we specialize in. And so it's like buying a condo. It's an investment property, and you're going to try to build value in that property and then at some point extract value. And, you know, but you've got to look at it like that investment, and like any investment, you can never afford to invest more than you can afford to. You can't count on it 100%. And in fact, invention is risky, and especially in the sense that there's just many factors beyond your control.
Chris, tell us a little bit. I know you're a member of the and on the board of the United Inventors Association. Tell us a little bit, in our audience, a little bit about the UIA.
Yeah, well, the UIA, as Bill, you well know, Bill's our vice president of the UIA, and just replacing Ron, so who was the previous vice president, and I'm on the board of directors as well. I'm no vice president, though. I'm just a normal run-of-the-mill board member, but we're a national nonprofit inventor education organization, and our job is to help inventors get educated so they can make intelligent decisions as they're trying to develop their invention, avoid wasting their money, and maximize their chances of success. And it's been a great experience for me to be on the board. I've met some really interesting and successful people, such as yourselves, and I've really been enjoying the learning opportunity that it's presented.
Okay. And what projects are you working on now, Chris?
We're always working on lots and lots of projects, both internally and externally generated. We just recently licensed a patent-pending lockbox system with a system that allows you to lock the box to a counter or to a shelf, and the application is for medications. So that's over half of the narcotics prescribed in this country are, quote, diverted, which means they're taken, people use them to get high instead of to treat pain. So there's a massive epidemic of people stealing pills, and so these are institutional-grade lock boxes for controlling your medications, and they'll be sold in hospitals, nursing homes, dental offices, veterinary offices, paramedics' homes, places like that, as well as the consumer market, but initially primarily focused on the institutional market, and it's called the Script Safe. We licensed it to a company called Flambeau, which is a very big box company. They make the Art Bin, they make tackle boxes and plastic toolboxes. Anyway, so that's a very exciting project that we're really excited about coming out this year. We're also in the middle of developing a CPAP mask. These are the breathing machines for people with sleep apnea. So it's a light medical device, and is very exciting because if it works as it seems like it's going to work, it could really transform the lives of the people who use these machines. So we work on, you know, a huge range of stuff. We're also working on a vegetable peeler, a whisk, and a garlic press for a kitchenwares company that'll be a family of products. So at any given time, we're in a bunch of different industries, which keeps the job really interesting as well. You know, there's never never the same thing twice. Well, that's not entirely true. This will be the fifth vegetable peeler we've designed, but every one of them has been different. So.
That's incredible.
I suppose each one has a different story, too, as far as, you know, there might be a problem with one piece of it one time, and then the next one, that piece, that problem is easy to overcome, but there's another problem. I suppose it's never the same.
Right. Well, and we're always standing on the shoulders of the previous one, so it's like instead of, you know, that becomes the new jumping off point. So how can we beat the last one we did, plus a different angle? Like the first peeler we did was a ceramic bladed peeler for the company Kyocera, and they were concerned because the ceramic blade only cut one direction. They wanted it to go both directions, so we came up with this adjustable angle head. So very cool, and it became a big success. It's actually been their number one product in that division for 7 years running now. And I think that's why people saw that product and associated with it. So they're like, make us a peeler, too. And only, what's the new angle? So it's coming up with a new angle that's the real challenge.
And Chris, you've developed what's called the perfect product pyramid. As we wrap up, can you share with us how that works?
Yeah, the perfect product pyramid is our little philosophy of product design. And really, I think it's something that can apply to any kind of product. Again, like not just a consumer product, but it can apply just as well to a service product, an insurance product, anything. And it's a three-layered pyramid, kind of like your food pyramid. And at the base of it is technology. And in the center is function. And at the top is design. So that base, the technology, is really about what's the premise, what's the fundamental thing that gives this product a reason to exist. So in products, we look for a patentable feature, but it might just be like if it's an insurance product, it's a novel type of insurance covering some new type of thing, but it's like not just another Me Too product. What's the thing about it that gives it, what is the fundamental premise? And then the middle layer, functionality, is executing the way the thing works with excellence. So now you have what it is and how it's going to work, what are all the functions going to be, what are all the features going to be. And then lastly, at the top is design. And as Apple Computer has shown us, it's not just about getting the job done anymore. It's about getting it done with style. The winner isn't who has the most horsepower, but the one who has the most style power. Because people have all of their needs met at this point. So design is not just about getting their needs met anymore. It's about adding style points to their everyday existence. That at Trident, our motto is transforming everyday tasks into opportunities to enjoy life. It's not just solving everyday tasks. It's transforming them into opportunities to enjoy life. And if you can do that, then you can have success. Now, if you have great design, great function, and a great premise, these things work in conjunction, if they're all in equal balance, to create a real knockout product. If you're missing any one of these three, if you've got a great idea and it's well executed, but it looks ugly, and when people look at it, they're not going to understand that it's cool unless you explain it to them, and by then you've usually lost the sale. If it looks cool but doesn't work well and doesn't have anything interesting to its premise, that's what we call designer, and with a capital D, and it usually costs 10 times as much and works half as well. So that's not what we're trying to make anyway. We're trying to create mass consumer products that achieve, high volume sales. And so you got to have all three of these things in balance.
All right. Well, thanks for being on our show today, Chris. Our listeners really appreciate you sharing your experiences and insights. It's been great.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Nice talking to you guys, and stay in touch.
Okay. Another great show, Bill.
It really was, Ron. Really appreciate you being on the show, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I also want to give a special thanks to today's sponsor, Envision Sales and Marketing. Envision Sales and Marketing, we go the extra step so you don't have to fret. Visit our website at envisionsalesandmarketing.com.
And you can go to our blog at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen again to today's show plus previous shows. This is Ron Reardon and Bill McHenry signing off another great session of The Launch Hour.